Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. As we do every week, I would like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. Kind of an introduction to our discussion this evening. The title of it, the title we could give to it, we hadn't really given one before, is Divorce in Old Age. It's a story of faith and imagination that we told for the first time in May of 1983. A man who was well thought of in the city and considered to be wise approached Jesus, accompanied by his wife, and said, "Master, I have been looking for you." Jesus responded, "Now that you have found me, what is on your mind?" "Is it wrong, Master, to leave the one who has slept at your side when there are no children?" Jesus did not answer, and so the man continued, "I have taken this woman as my wife, but I have grown old now and can no longer care for her. I would like to give her to another so that she might bear children and experience fulfillment. Again, I ask, is this wrong, Master?" Jesus at first remained silent. The woman looked at him with tears in her eyes and said, "Master, I don't wish to leave him. I know I won't bear any children if I stay with him, but I want to care for him as he has cared for me. He has been a good and kind man." Jesus looked at the wise man and said, "You do not speak the truth." The man was obviously embarrassed by Jesus' words. "Again, I say to you, do not speak the truth." The old man looked down at the ground. Jesus said, "You have found another more to your liking." "She's younger," the old man explained. And the woman began to cry. Jesus said to the man, "Do not use your concern for others as an excuse for your own desire. I am not your judge, nor is any other man, but I tell you this, love is a gift which man and woman give to one another. Whether this love bears fruit is my Father's will. It is wrong to pick a wife like one would pick a piece of fruit from a tree." The man raised his eyes, looked at Jesus, and said, "I picked her because of her great beauty, which is now beginning to fade, and I found another." Jesus responded, "Look into the well and look deep into your eyes. No man wants to grow old, tired, or sick, but age comes to all. Age is a gift. One knows from the moment of birth that one day he must return to the Father's home. The man is foolish indeed who sees only the beauty in youth and not the wisdom in age." We're getting our guest on the line now, and we will be talking to her. But what I would like to do is, she writes in these concluding words in her latest book titled Gray Divorce, G-R-A-Y, Gray Divorce, What We Lose and Gain from Midlife Splits. Gray divorce need not represent the devastating end of two people's lives. While we all hope for happily ever afters, when it comes to older couples, the reality is that this might not be possible. If a couple's marital relationship has irretrievably broken down, they are no longer duty-bound legally or culturally to remain together until death. True, divorcing people must often work through grief, disappointment, and pain. Then women must predominantly reckon with a difficult economic gray divorce penalty, while men must sort through a harsh social divorce penalty. Still, there is every chance that in the not-so-distant future, each can not only put their lives back together again, but also can embark on a promising new road of happiness and self-fulfillment going into the future. Our guest is Dr. Jocelyn Elise Crowley. She's a professor of public policy, a member of the graduate faculty in the Department of Political Science. It's an affiliated faculty member of the Department of Women's and Gender Studies and a senior faculty fellow at the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers, and that is the State University of New Jersey. She's been involved in many research projects on mothers' organizations in the United States, parenting challenges in public policy, and workplace flexibility. We still don't have her on the air yet. Don't know quite what's happening, but our producer's trying to reach her, the number that she gave me, and I'd already talked to her beforehand, so I know she's going to, she will be there. But she also writes in her book about a gray divorce, and let's try to set the stage a little bit more before hopefully we get her. She writes, "This is a mystery called gray divorce, defined as a divorce occurring at or after the age of 50. Many of these divorces take place after 20, 30, or even 40 years of marriage. They tend to shock the consciences, both near and far, of those who witness the implosion. The questions simply go on and on. Why would couples in midlife want to make such a drastic change in their marital status? Haven't they seemed to deftly maneuver through the ups and downs of typical married life so far? Don't they care about the time that they have already invested in each other? Haven't they already successfully raised children to adulthood or close to it together? What could possibly go wrong at this stage in their lives? Aren't they with their soulmates by now?" So our producer is still trying to get her on the line. For some reason, he can't get her. Maybe he can call someone and find out how to do this. It's a connection I know that she's waiting for. So we'll see what it is and that we can do. But I was really surprised by this book. Not the kind of topic that I typically deal with, because it doesn't deal with the religious aspects, but insofar as it was something really new, I thought that it was, and it looks like it's going to be something that really is going to happen in the future, then, and there's going to be a tsunami of gray divorces some 10 years from now. She writes, and hopefully we will have her, what we lose and gain from midlife splits. And there's many questions that she raises that really give us a whole lot of understanding about reasons for gray divorce, financial worries from a gray divorce, and also talks about people who need people, that relationships with friends and adult family members after gray divorce change in so many different ways, and relations with children after a gray divorce also happen. So while we're still trying to get her on the line, we may be having some technical difficulties here before we find her. Let's just try to talk a little bit about what today was. Today is the feast of Pentecost. Welcome back to Amplify. As we're probably in open conversation for now. Maybe during the second hour, we'll try to get in touch with our guest. Maybe some telephone problems. We're not quite sure at this point. But I began to talk about. Sorry, I was talking right into the break. Didn't expect it to come at that particular point. But today is the feast of Pentecost. The season of Easter has ended, and we've been blessed in so many ways by Easter. And it comes down to the fact that we are loved by God, and so many, many, many different ways. And that means that, and it shouldn't surprise us because there's so many ways in which we are loved by God. So let me just say to my producer that I have, that my guest is waiting there for the phone to ring, but it hasn't happened yet. But the fact of the Pentecost means that just as we have experienced in our life God's love in so many different ways, Easter shows us that it's loved in one way, and then, of course, Pentecost in another way, through the emphasis of the third person. We're loved by Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And the Spirit of God loves us so much that it actually enters our life and becomes a part of us. And being a part of us then is able in so many ways then to help us to understand how much it is that God has loved us. Let me break away from that. They have been able to get our guest on the phone. Professor Crowley, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sorry for the problems. We've had some phone issues here.
That's okay. I know all about phone issues.
and couldn't reach you. But what I've done is I've read from the final words of your book as a beginning. On page 176, it's the last page of the book. I read the last paragraph to talk about what Gray Divorce is about, and another paragraph from the book to sort of give some background to what is happening. Tell us why you got interested in various family issues that you've addressed in your career. It seems like the family has really interested you, its well-being.
Yes, absolutely it has. You know, I grew up in a very, very strong Catholic family, and, you know, my parents were, you know, really, really good, stable figures in my life. And this was during the 1970s, and unfortunately, my father, when I was 7 years old, ended up leaving our family. And that created a lot of difficulties for us. My mom was raising my sister and I on somewhat of a low income. She had been a teacher. She had taken time out of working to take care of us. And then when my father left, because there wasn't good child support enforcement during the 1970s, she actually had to go back to work. She worked 7 days a week. She worked 5 days a week as an administrative assistant and then 2 days a week at Sears, and, you know, went back to school and really sacrificed a lot for us. So I think all of that young experience in terms of a family breaking apart had really, really important consequences for me as I got older, you know, and ultimately when I went on to get my PhD, I was really interested in the intersection between families, family formation, family dissolution, and what we can do as a society to address the problems caused by divorce. So those kind of themes have been in an important part of my research for my entire career. And I would say that this book in particular was really brought about by my experiences with my grandparents. My grandparents were married for 68 years, and they fought like every single other couple, but there was never any talk of divorce. There was never even a sense that was even on the table. So about 7 or 8 years ago, when I read an article discussing the statistics regarding gray divorce or divorce over the age of 50, I thought to myself, I really want to talk to these people who had undergone this experience, because it was so contrary to what I had experienced with my own grandparents. So it's a theme that's really gone through all of my work, but also personal family circumstances really motivated me to get started on this type of research.
And in your research, have you seen that there's been much change in the way we look at the importance of family life in society?
You know, when I was, so overall, when I've talked to people across the age spectrum, so not just this, not for just this book, looking at people over the age of 50, I really do find that in my work, people really do want to make marriages work, and they struggle to do so against a lot of challenges, whatever the types of challenges that all marriages face. They want to go ahead. They want to make it work. And I found that, you know, that being running across many books that I've written, that often couples go into counseling, oftentimes couples counseling, and then sometimes into individual counseling as well, and they really do make an effort. So rarely have I spoken to people who just want to throw away their marriage at the first fight. Right. I rarely, rarely found that.
We have just about 2 minutes to our break. Tell us a little bit then how we should understand the term gray divorce.
Sure. So a gray divorce is simply a divorce that has occurred where one member of the couple is age 50 or older. And what it's really important to know about gray divorce right now is that the overall divorce rate in the country has actually stabilized, and among certain age groups has actually declined, which is a good thing. But among the age group 50 and older, it has actually doubled. So from 1990 to 2010, the gray divorce rate doubled. That means now one out of every four divorces is gray, meaning that one partner is at least age 50 and older. And in 2010, about 630,000 individuals went through a gray divorce, and we expect that by 2030, that number to go up to over 800,000. So it is a significant phenomenon, and it is continuing to grow in size.
And you begin your book, as you just stated, that you believe that it's a coming tidal wave. You really give a lot of importance of how we're going to be affected by this.
Absolutely. There it is, you know, with so many different trends, you know, pushing people forward, in particular, the aging of the baby boomer generation, increased life expectancy, and then just decreased stigma associated with the divorce. We expect the gray divorce to continue to climb over the next several decades.
All right, we're going to take our first break. We're speaking with Professor and Dr. Jocelyn Elise Crowley. She's written a book called Gray Divorce, What We Lose and Gain from Midlife Splits. And after we come back from the break, we'll continue our discussion. Welcome back to Amplify with Professor Jocelyn Crowley. We're talking about her book, Gray Divorce, What We Lose and Gain from Midlife Splits. Certainly, Professor, one of the most important aspects of the book is the difference between an economic gray divorce penalty for women and a social divorce penalty for men. Say a little bit about that. I know you talk about it throughout the book.
Sure. So in addition to talking about the causes of gray divorce, which we can definitely talk about later on, what I really focus on are the consequences of divorce. And what I say is that they are very, very different for men and for women. So as part of this whole book, I interviewed 40 men and 40 women who had experienced a gray divorce throughout their lives. And these men and women were not married to each other, so they were completely independent. And when I asked them about, you know, some of their fears going forward, the men and the women had very, very different answers. So for the women, they talked a lot about worrying that they would need to work until the day that they died, or having to borrow money from their parents to survive or to live more frugally. They were much more concerned about these ideas of being able to be financially well off after their gray divorces. And the reason why this is true is that women have been making progress in terms of getting involved with working for pay, getting involved with participating outside of the home in the labor force, but they still participate to a lower degree than men. And unfortunately, to wage discrimination, they still only make about 82 cents to every male dollar. So what this means is that, you know, women are the ones who usually take time out from working for pay to have a baby, and then ultimately to raise that child overall for a period of time, whatever she can afford. So during that time, she's not, you know, she's not doing anything in terms of contributing to her savings account. When she does return to work, like I said, she usually makes less money than a man. She's usually employed in an occupation where there are a lot of women, meaning that, you know, we think about these jobs where there are a lot of women, they tend to be lower paid than jobs where there are a lot of men. And what we've also found from some of the research is that employers pay mothers less than they do childless women. And we're not quite sure exactly why that's the case, but one of the reasons, one of the things that we think about is that employers tend to stereotype mothers as less committed to their jobs than childless women, so they end up paying them less. All of these factors come together so that ultimately when a woman is age 50 or older and she experiences a gray divorce, she has less money saved in her savings account. She has less money put away in her 401k if she has one or in her pension. And she has less money saved in her Social Security benefit package. So right now we know that women take home about $14,000 every year to every man's $18,000 a year in benefits from Social Security. So those are severe economic consequences that women face. And in the book, I talk about, and we can talk about a little bit later if you'd like, what we can do about that, what we can do as a society to address that. But I also want to tell you that men face a severe penalty as well, and I call that the social grade divorce penalty. So in speaking to the men as part of this project, what I found was that men often lost family members, friends, and adult children as a result of the gray divorce. One man told me that he had been going to the same church for 30 years, and after his divorce, he went to church to, you know, his ex-wife's father had died, so he went to pay his respects, and no one in the church would talk to him.
Yeah.
Another man talked about losing his daughter over the divorce, that she sided with the mother. And so, you know, wives, when couples are together, wives tend to be the social directors of the marriage. They get families together, they make dates with other couples, and so forth. And when the family actually dissolves, men end up losing all of those social supports and social networks. They end up being really isolated and alone. They lose adult family members, they lose couple friends, and most significantly, they lose their adult children as sources of support. So again, you know, men face the social grade divorce penalty. There are things that we can do to help them, just like we can do to help women face the economic grade divorce penalty that they experience after the age of 50.
The case studies are wonderful. They're so helpful. You learn so much from, and I hope we get to some of them. You've already mentioned a couple of them, but reading them really helped, I think, to make me understand what is meant by gray divorce, because you refer to it as a kind of a mystery. And I read from that paragraph while we were trying to get to you with the change that is taking place. In fact, you refer to it as a seismic shift in individual priorities that has affected our view of marriage, that's raised by such questions as why would couples in midlife want to make such a drastic change? Haven't they seemed to be able to maneuver through ups and downs? Don't they care about the time they've already invested in each other? Haven't they successfully raised children? And what could possibly go wrong at this time? Aren't they with their soulmates by now? So divorce has really become a widely approved as a suitable termination of a contract between two people who were no longer happy together. And so it's changed in many ways, hasn't it?
Absolutely. You know, once I started this project, I came into the project with a certain idea about what I was going to hear from these couples regarding, you know, why they were splitting up. And family researchers and family scholars have basically said there are two models of marriage that are out there. There's this first very traditional model of marriage whereby men and women get together due to love, but that they're also bound to one another with mutual obligations and responsibilities, whether that be, you know, maybe the man stereotypically is earning more money, maybe the woman is doing more of the child care, but they're bound to each other, and they're bound to each other through thick and thin. And only under grave circumstances where one half of the couple engages in self-destructive behaviors or destructive behaviors towards the other spouse is divorce even thought of. So that would be the case of my grandparents and actually yes. My parents as well. So my grandparents never thought about it, right? But in terms of my own parents, it was the case that my father ended up having an affair. So it was a destructive behavior towards my mother. So in those cases where we have destructive behaviors like adultery, emotional abuse, any type of addictions and so forth, then we could contemplate a divorce. The second model of marriage says, you know what, the baby boomer generation, which mm-hmm. is what I studied, the baby boomer generation is going to have a completely different idea of what marriage is and why we might go ahead and think about divorce as a possibility. So the baby boomer generation has this stereotype, right, of being the me generation. I'm going to do things that are fulfilling to me. And only if I'm not personally happy anymore, I'm not growing, I'm not fulfilled, would I contemplate a divorce. So very, very different reasons for becoming or being part of a marriage, and then very, very different reasons for ultimately splitting up. So examples of baby boomers possibly splitting up, the reasons might be, oh, I just fell out of love, or, yes. oh, I'm no longer growing in this marriage, or, oh, this person doesn't share my interests. So very, very different types of reasons based on self-fulfillment, the me generation, and so forth. So I actually went into the project thinking that those were the reasons I was going to hear about primarily. I was going to hear about these couples basically saying, I'm no longer having fun in this couple, as being part of this couple, and therefore I'm going to go out and seek a divorce. And I was very, very wrong. So that's always the fun part of the research project, when you, research process rather, when you have these ideas about what you think you're going to hear, and then when you actually go out in the field and you talk to people going through these experiences, and you find out, oh no, what I expected was it to happen really didn't happen. So, you know, couples ended up getting divorced for very, very different reasons. And I talk about that in the book, and mm-hmm. we can talk about that tonight. But
okay.
The men and women had some common reasons for getting a divorce, but there were also very different reasons for getting a divorce as well between men and women.
Okay, we're going to take this break, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to Amplify, where we are talking with Professor Jocelyn Crowley about her book, A Gray Divorce. A lot of questions we could ask. She writes, in a summary, a growing divorce culture, the rise in life expectancy, the emergence of no-fault laws created a fertile environment for the gray divorce phenomenon, not only to take root, but also to feverishly spread across the 50 states into the 21st century. So we've gotten older, and therefore marriages can last longer. The development of the no-fault divorce laws have affected probably our attitudes and our beliefs in in many ways. And she also writes, the common experiences of emotional upheaval emerge when couples finally decide to go forward with their gray divorces. And Professor, I know that there is no one concept of love. There are many concepts of love. But has the way people look at love, as it seems to be easier to say, you know, I just fell out of love and that's all there is to it. So has our understanding, our concept of love also been affected through all of these changes?
You know, when I spoke to these people over the age of 50, you know, a small set of them, both men and women, talked about growing apart as the primary reason why they got a divorce. And so I remember one man said to me, you know, I fell in love with my wife very, very quickly, and we went to Paris, and I proposed to her, and it was very romantic. And then ultimately when we came back to the United States, what happened was that I went ahead and I pursued degree after degree after degree, and she wasn't really interested in my educational pursuits. She didn't really have anything to say about them and wasn't really, really concerned with what I was actually studying. And so we basically grew apart. But, you know, I would say that overall our ideas about love continue to be pretty traditional. You know, the people that I spoke with really, really fought long and hard for their marriages, and they were willing to do a lot of different things to try to make sure that these marriages worked, go to counseling, you know, seek out sometimes religious guidance about their marriages. They weren't ones to just go ahead and throw it away. So, you know, overall, I would say that traditional ideas about love are still very, very important in the United States. And people don't throw away their marriages lightly. They really go ahead and try, for the majority of them, try to work things out and to try to preserve what they have spent so many years in trying to create. So I'm an optimist when it comes to love.
Great.
I'm an optimist when it comes to people coming together and spending the rest of their lives together. I think that there are challenges and there are significant pressures on modern marriage, and you know, a lot of that has to do with the internet and social media and the ability of people to connect with other people that might raise temptations for people to act outside of their marriages. I definitely think that that's new and different, and that's a very, very important trend that we've got to keep our eye on in terms of, you know, really pushing forward this great divorce phenomenon or slowing it down. But the most of the people I spoke with did have these very, very traditional ideas about love. And, you know, I myself continued to hold on to them as well.
Right. In your study of 40 men and 40 women, you asked them, why did you get divorced? And you ranked them in order of mention. The men said, we grew apart. Two, wives engaged in physical cheating. Three, wives had financial differences, problems. Four, wives had mental health problems. And five, problems related to their children. The women were different in some ways, but not. Their first was husbands engaged in physical cheating. Husbands had pornography, alcohol, drug addictions. Husbands engaged in verbal and emotional abuse. We grew apart. And husbands had mental health problems. So there's some of the same, and yet there's some distinct differences, aren't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. And those differences, I think, are very, very important. The commonalities are, you know, issues of growing apart, issues of adultery, and then issues related to mental illness, where they believed that their partner was actually engaged or had some type of mental illness, whether or not that was diagnosed by a medical professional or not, that was a different story. Or they were just saying, I think that my partner has this mental illness. But yes, very, very different ideas as well, with men pointing to financial differences and differences regarding raising their children, and then women primarily pointing to addictions as well as verbal and emotional abuse as strong reasons as to why they pursued a divorce.
And so give us a case or two, one that's you think there's something we can learn a lot from, like you've done, maybe a man's case and a woman's case. We just have about 3 minutes, so maybe pick one right now, 3 minutes before we go to our next break.
I would say, So for where men and women had a commonality, for example, adultery.
Yes.
One woman came on the phone and I did all these interviews on the phone, and she said, "Oh, the primary reason, you know, we got a divorce was adultery. I found a receipt from a hotel in my husband's jacket, and I was pretty sure I wasn't there at the time." So that's how she found out. Mental illness was also mentioned by couples, both men and women. And one man said that his wife had been severely depressed for a long period of time, and she was on an antidepressant. However, that antidepressant wasn't working, and he kept encouraging her to go back to her psychiatrist, and she wouldn't do it. So all of that begging, you know, really, really was not effective, and ultimately they end up getting a divorce because in his mind she wasn't willing to go out there and do the work that she needed to do in order to get better. And again, the differences, there were significant differences between men and women as well, and you know, we can definitely talk about examples from those differences as well.
And certainly women speaking about pornography, alcohol, drug addictions, as a priest, I can testify to that in terms of what I hear. And you have one story about Brenda, and she confronted her husband, you write, with this knowledge, and he admitted to viewing them. And she explained to him that every time he looked at these images, she felt like he was cheating on her. And he listened and vowed to be better, but eventually went back to the same behavior because it can be so powerful and so addictive. And she finally gave him an ultimatum announcing that either he could get help for his addiction or the marriage was over. And she hoped that would change his ways, even with religious intervention.
Yes.
But it only got worse.
It only got worse. It only got worse. And that was a really, really common theme for women, that internet pornography, I think, is something that we really need to take a long, a serious look at. It is a serious issue in contemporary society, and to the extent that it devalues a marriage or it devalues or degrades either partner in that marriage, I think it can be very, very destructive. So I really believe that we as a society, as well as within religious communities, yes, as well, need to take this on. And I, you know, speaking for myself, I don't hear.
Let me break in. We have a hard break now. So let me take this hard break, and then we'll pick up where we left off. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify, where Dr. Jocelyn Crowley, who's a professor of public policy at Rutgers University, State University in New Jersey, is with us. She has written a book called Gray Divorce, Why We Lose and Gain, What We Lose and Gain from Midlife Splits. Is there a thought you'd like to finish from the first hour, Professor?
Yes, I was just trying to say that we were talking a little bit about the differences between men and women and why they had undergone this divorce, and I had mentioned that the men really focused on financial reasons as well as differences with their wives in terms of raising the children, and these issues were really interesting to me. So for the men, they often talked about what they called their wives' financial infidelity. So oftentimes they would get bills or something that would come in the mail, and they wouldn't know that their wives had actually gone out and spent this money. So this would be a big surprise, and it would cause a lot of conflict within the marriage. What was really interesting to me, though, was most of the children were adults by the time their parents had gone through a great divorce. And they really carried a lot of intense feelings that their wives weren't necessarily good parents. They worried a lot about their wives not disciplining their children, in particular boys, as much as they thought they should. So one man talked to me about how his son got really bad grades, but his wife nonetheless let him go out and play sports in the afternoon. Another one said that his wife would continuously pay his son's speeding tickets or traffic tickets without his knowledge and wouldn't discipline the kids accordingly if they had these types of traffic problems. And then we were talking a little bit before the break about the wives and what they had gone through. And the first thing that I'd mention was emotional and verbal abuse. So many women talk to me about the names that their husbands called them, the profanities that they used, and the worst example that I encountered in the book was when a woman who had brought in a child from a previous relationship into her new marriage, the new husband was very controlling, and this daughter was overweight. And he kept saying to his wife, you know, you've got to get the food under control. You got to get her to be more disciplined. And then one day he actually put a padlock on the refrigerator. So once he did that very, very extremely abusive action, she knew that she had to get out. But we were talking about women and the types of addictions that they were really, really suffering under. So these were drug addictions, they were alcohol addictions, and they were also internet pornography addictions. And for alcohol, many times it was the wives would talk about the fact that their husbands were involved in some types of businesses where alcohol was really, really readily available. So, for example, the restaurant business or the bar business, and their husbands being mostly always intoxicated, or even if they weren't in these businesses, that they had severe alcohol problems. And then in terms of internet pornography, you know, you talked about the case of, I believe it was Brenda, where she basically said, every time my husband looks at these images, I feel like he's cheating on me. And that was a sentiment that I heard from women all over, you know, that they would try to do their best to encourage their husbands to stop engaging in this behavior, but they just couldn't. Even if they went ahead and they went to counseling, they just couldn't stop it. And this is a problem that's really, really significant in contemporary American society and something that we need to do a lot about. Personally, I haven't heard much discussion in the religious communities about this issue, and I think it's really, really fundamental to get it out there so we can talk about it and address it in order to save marriages over the long run.
Right. Let's talk now about the economic gray divorce penalty. You write that there are many paths to a gray divorce that can be very painful, and one of the most difficult is separating their financial holdings, that the process can lead to inequitable results between the sexes, and women seem to get the worst of it. But both men and women must confront different concerns as they relate to money management once they are single again. And so divorce sometimes forces them to examine their financial lives, and that health care and health insurance becomes a serious financial concern, and that women are four times as likely as men to be afraid of being financially destitute after splitting up with their spouses. And so tell us a little bit, and you have the chart on page 75, about the financial worries from a gray divorce that you learned from your study, the differences between men and women.
Sure. So, you know, I want to emphasize that the majority of people that I spoke with were middle class. So they didn't have this severe severe financial penalties that working class people or poor individuals have over the age of 50. You know, men really didn't have a lot of significant financial worries. They often found themselves in situations where, you know, they had worked continuously through their lives, they hadn't taken time out to raise children, and they rarely talked about being worried or being concerned or having strategies to manage their financial worries. Whereas the women definitely worried a lot more. And some of the strategies that they came up with was relying on their parents. You know, one woman told me that she was fortunate enough to get a check from her parents to help her as she went through this entire process, and she hoped that that would help her throughout her entire life. Or they were really relying on their parents to help them in other ways. They also talked about becoming more frugal in their lives and spending less money, the necessity of doing that because, you know, their finances really, really put them in a precarious position. And then other women just basically said, you know, I'm going to have to work until the day I die. I can't see myself retiring because of the financial circumstances that I'm in. And these are, you know, differences between the sexes that we really, really need to consider when we're thinking about a great divorce. Splitting property that was common to marriage is done by judges in the majority of cases. And oftentimes, you know, what we might consider equal splitting of property between men and women can have unequal results. In particular, if the woman is so significantly behind her husband in terms of earning power because she's taken time out to raise children and she doesn't have the savings that her husband has. So, you know, if a judge says, okay, we'll divide the house, we'll sell the house and we'll divide it equally between the man and the woman, you know, yeah, that seems equal on its surface, but what is the underlying earning power between men and women that is really going to keep this couple very, very unequal after a divorce? So we need to keep those circumstances in mind as well.
And your summaries are wonderful. You write, a gray divorce signals the end of an important romantic relationship between two mature adults. Emotions can be very raw because two lives that have been highly intertwined are now set on new paths to move in separate directions. Undoubtedly, untangling the finances between these two parties unleashes additional stress upon them. But this pain is not evenly distributed. Women pay a much higher economic gray divorce penalty than men for the variety of reasons outlined earlier. They suffer disproportionately in the area of receiving their fair share of marital assets and debts, securing stable income streams, and protecting their health and well-being. Yet, a divorce involves much more than the often heated division of money. And so let's go to the next chapter, People Who Need People. And you point out that men rather than women are more likely to pay a higher social gray divorce penalty, that men and women tend to differ in the types of close relationships that they establish with friends and adult family members over their lives, and that when men and women divorce, their relationships with both individuals and other couples change, and so relationships with children are affected. Whether they're young or old, there is still stress. And it's interesting that the studies that you did show that children tend to side with their mothers rather than their fathers in circumstances like these. So tell us a little bit about relationships with friends and adult family members after a gray divorce.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, when a couple is together, the woman is predominantly what I call sort of the social director of the marriage, and she gets family members together and she gets friends together. She's often the one who makes the plans. And prior to a gray divorce, not only does she do that, but research has consistently shown that men and women form very different types of relationships. They have very different types of friendships. So women's friendships tends to be based a lot on common discussions about problems and issues and emotions that are going on in their lives. And men's friendships are often based around activities, right? So while this is all going on, you know, we also know that women still do the majority of child care in the United States within families. So if we track over time, we see that men are spending more time doing housework and child care, but they still lag far, far behind women in those two activities. So what ultimately ends up happening is if there is a gray divorce, what happens to the adult family members who are left behind? What happens to the couples who are friends with them? And what happens with the adult children? Well, research has shown, and my research actually holds this up as well, that many adults tend to side with the women after a gray divorce. And interestingly, adult children, men and women, tend to side with the mother. Now, we think that this might be the case because the woman did the majority of child care and child caregiving during the entire marriage. And so men suffer extraordinarily there. I would say, though, if a father is alienated from his child for a period of time, it doesn't last forever. And I did see where there was some thawing of relationships after a period of time. But men do experience this severe social isolation. And that's really, really an important issue for society to think about, because as men age, they're going to need more and more care, right, from family members, from their children, as their health needs demand. And so if they lose those types of social relationships, in particular from their children, they are really going to be in a very, very difficult position, and society is going to end up picking up the bill, right, for taking care of these men if they need to go to hospitals or other types of institutions because their children won't take care of them. So that's also just a very, very important public policy consideration.
And you do that. You talk a lot about that in your last chapter. You point out that social support, as you've just said, during and after a gray divorce, is extremely important to the health and well-being of those going through this transition. So you make recommendations on how we might be able to do that. And it was interesting to me in terms of relationships with children after a gray divorce. Both the men and the women, their number one choice was that they depended on the child. And the second in order of mention was men said the children supported their ex-wives, and the women said, yes, children supported me. So your study also showed that, too.
At least.
Yes. So that was fascinating.
And I do think it has to do with the fact that women still are the majority of their caregivers in American society. And, you know, regardless of who caused the divorce or the reason, they do tend to ally themselves with the mothers. But like I said, over time, their relationships with the fathers do improve. So not all is lost, but they do improve over time. It's just a matter of giving that relationship time to get better. And then men ultimately, or hopefully, will have those relationships back.
I don't want to point out to people, although I'm trying to work through the book so we touch a little bit on everything in the study that you present in it, from your study in it, that there are many case studies that are fascinating. And I think when you read those, you think about, oh, I can believe that, or I don't believe that, or I know someone like that, or boy, that's me. That reflects me in the situation that I'm in. And so I think the case studies are critically and important. And so that I haven't missed anything, let me read then part of the summary of this chapter. You write, women divorcing in later years are much more likely than men to pay a high economic penalty. This does not mean, however, that men are unscathed when a divorce hits in midlife. As this discussion has documented, men are much more likely to pay a higher social grade divorce penalty than women. Both men and women admit that friends and adult family members tend to ally themselves with their wives after marital breakdown. In addition, children who are mostly young adults at the time of their parents' separation can have mixed reactions to the news of a divorce. When they do have an opinion, they are also more likely to side with their mothers than their fathers. While facing economic and social divorce penalties, couples going through these transitions also experience extraordinary personal grief. They are mourning the loss of what could have been the most important partnership of the later years of their lives. Yet although these negative feelings are both painful and serious, most individuals do not just stop living. In fact, in the wake of a gray divorce, both men and women have the opportunity to redefine themselves and map out their new futures going forward. And so at one point you're writing that they experience extraordinary personal grief, but there's still hope there that you end, that they do have an opportunity to make the future better than they thought.
Absolutely. And that's where I work on talking about, for them personally, what is the worst part about being divorced at this point in their lives, and what is the best part about being divorced at this point in their lives. And there were a lot of commonalities between the men and women in thinking about the worst part. So beyond the social and economic gray divorce penalties, personally, what was hardest for them? There was a lot of overlap between men and women, and then also there was significant overlap when they talked about the best part of being divorced at this point in their lives. So not all was lost in the gray divorce. They had a lot to say about those types of personal costs and then the things that they were looking forward to as well.
So it's just fascinating that despite all that happens, there is hope. And so right now, I think we're going for a break. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify. We have just about 20 minutes, a little less than 20 minutes. We end about 5 minutes before the hour. Our guest is Professor Jocelyn Crowley. We're talking about her book titled Gray Divorce, and we're up to one of the final chapters now to talk about moving forward personally. And she writes within this paragraph, we've seen that those directly affected by marital splits have to confront the inevitable gray divorce penalties that come before them. For women, these are primarily economic penalties. And for men, these are chiefly social penalties. These penalties are substantial hurdles to overcome, and both sexes are likely to have setbacks as they move forward. However, there are roller coasters ahead. After a period of time, many people do gain at least somewhat stable footing so that they can begin to evaluate their future lives in all of their complexities. The most important point to note is that the period of time after a midlife divorce is not static or black and white. It is dynamic and fluid, with the quote-unquote bad effects facing squarely off with the quote-unquote good effects as each person shapes their new life. Professor, tell us a little bit about the good and the bad.
Yeah, and the good, bad, and the ugly, right?
Yes.
Really, I was so interested in how they thought about their lives going forward. So these were people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and they had just gone through this really, really difficult, transformative, transition in their lives of having a divorce. And I think, again, I initially expected, in speaking to them, that they might feel crushed, that they might feel just overwhelmed with grief and, very, very depressed. And while you know, I did find a lot of negative feelings about what they had gone through. Overwhelmingly, they were very, very positive about their lives going forward. So let me talk a little bit about the negative aspects of going through a gray divorce. So in speaking to both the men and the women, they both had these very similar senses of sadness regarding their gray divorce. And the primary emotion that they identified was loneliness.
That was interesting. So, they both agreed on that.
Yeah, I mean, so men and women, you know, they said, you know, Jocelyn, the worst part of this is having no one to come home to. So I'm coming home, and it's me, and it's myself. And another woman said to me, what's hardest is this loneliness, and I don't have someone to call during the day to tell them what's going on with my life. I don't really have anyone to reach out to and say, this happened or that happened. I can go out with a girlfriend, but it's not necessarily the same as having a partner and saying, you know, this is absolutely, you know, this is what's going on, and having someone to depend on. So loneliness by far was common across men and women in terms of the worst thing that they had to face in their divorce. Women also talked a little bit about finances and their financial worries. But then I turned to ask them all, what is the best part about being divorced at this stage in their lives? And overwhelmingly, the men and women had very, very similar answers. They talked a lot about freedom and independence that they had going forward. And then also a general sense of happiness and no longer having to be around their ex-partner anymore. And these were actually some of the funniest cases where they really got to let loose and talk about what made them happy after their great divorce. So one man said to me, you know what? The best part about being divorced at this stage in my life is I get to turn the television on Sundays in the fall and watch football all day long, and no one tells me not to. Another man said to me, you know, I love to cook. And when I'm in the kitchen, I admit it, I'm kind of messy. And my ex-wife, she always would come into the kitchen and she would say, why do you have all of these pots and pans out? You're driving me crazy. You don't need to cook with all of these pots and pans. And he said, you know, once I got divorced, I figured out that I could cook in any way that I wanted to, and no one was going to bother me about the pots and the pans. And that was very, very liberating. In the same way, the women talked so much about freedom and independent. So one woman said to me, you know, when I go shopping in a store for something for the home, whether that be pillows or curtains, I don't have to think about him and whether or not he would say, like these pillows, or whether he would like these curtains. As she said, I don't have to think about whether these things would make him happy, because the only thing I need to think about is whether it's going to make me happy. That's me and my new in my new home and in my new existence without him. And then one of the funniest women said to me, you know, the best part about being divorced right now is that I don't have to deal with my stupid ex-husband. He was so stupid all the time. One time I was sitting in the living room and I heard him in the other room giving out my credit card number. And she was mystified by this, and he came out and he said, oh yeah, honey, we just, you know, won a trip to Hawaii or wherever it was. They just wanted, when they called and told me this, they just wanted your credit card number just to secure the trip. So obviously that wasn't the smartest thing to do, to give out the credit card number. So she said, you know, finally I don't have to deal with what she called stupid anymore. I can live my life safely and freely on my own. So those were the commonalities in terms of the negative things that these couples were going through, but then ultimately the positive things that these couples and individuals were going through. They really left their gray divorces with a strong sense of, this was very, very sad and tragic, but the majority of them said that they were looking forward to this new chapter in their lives. And only a couple of people said that there was nothing positive about being divorced at this stage in their lives.
Right. Joyce summarized her feelings about being grateful to not have to deal with her ex-partner anymore as simply appreciation, quote, to have peace and quiet and not to have to hear all this religious fanatical stuff going on. And if she were to try, if she were ever to try seriously dating again, she insisted she would first have that person professionally investigated. So
that was another good one too. I mean, I think what was some of the more interesting aspects also of this whole process was the extent to which religion and morality played into some of the causes of divorce and then ultimately some of the relief afterwards. So for a couple of people, they just said, you know, my wife or my husband, you know, they just fell away from God and they fell away from religion and I wasn't like that. And I, you know, I really wanted to stick to my belief system and my ex-partners were no longer doing that. They were no longer living a life where that was compatible with God's ideals for them and their behavior. And then there was some relief, you know, there was at the end when there was a divorce, if a partner felt that their partner, ex-partner was overly zealous in terms of religion or believed in some religious principles that they didn't believe in, then in fact they were happy about the gray divorce and they were happy that they no longer had to have something that they felt might have been very, very difficult for them to conform to religiously. They no longer had to do that. So that was very freeing for them as well.
One thing that I thought I could understand was that Julie talked about loneliness, and that was the number one cause, the bad for both men and women. But she defined loneliness in a broader way, who described it in the context of both a loss of shared responsibilities, but also a loss of intimacy. I thought maybe the loneliness was really a loss of intimacy in many ways.
Yeah, you know, so there were people who said, I'm missing my partner who would help me do things, like, right? Like run the house or bring in money or, you know, just take care of things, household issues that would come up. But yes, the severe significant loss with this was this loss of intimacy in terms of emotionally being able to connect with someone. And as you might imagine, after a great divorce, you are completely losing that person in whom you confide, that one person who tends to be your, you know, marital partner in life. So to lose that was such a significant blow for them. And you know, I would say, though, that the majority of people I spoke with, I think it might have been 79 out of the 80 people I spoke with, they were just 2 years or less out from their divorce. So they were very much in the early stages. And so I think that that's a process of still grieving the marriage and still mourning the marriage. And perhaps with time, those feelings of loneliness and sadness would dissipate, and maybe more of the feelings of freedom and happiness and a sense of, you know, a new start would move forward and come into more prominence into their mind going forward.
And you, as you've just pointed out, the divorcing couples report having much to look forward to as they set upon this new direction in their lives. And you write, recall that previous research suggested that the four best parts of being divorced were independence and freedom, a chance to start over, not having to deal with a toxic ex-partner, and financial control. And again, the only difference between the sexes is that men prioritized a chance to start over, and that was ranked second, mm-hmm. while women reported simply being happier. So there is a difference between men and women, isn't there? There's certainly a likeness, but there is a difference, too.
There are some differences, though, in terms of, like, the subtleties of how they expressed it. So, as you mentioned, women talked a lot more about just simply being happier in this part of their lives. You know, one of the most interesting parts, and I really didn't discuss it too much in the book, was I did ask all of these individuals, would they ever consider being remarried? And so I wrote an article on this, and again, I don't think it's touched upon, maybe just by a couple of people. And what's fascinating is that the men, the majority of men said yes. Oh, I'd get remarried right away. Even though they had gone through this terrible experience, they were really, really looking for a partner. So even though they, right at that moment, 2 years or less after getting a great divorce, they were very happy with a chance to start over, I think it's important for us to understand that for them, a part of starting over meant, for many of them, I want to get remarried. In fact, they said to me, I believe just to have a companion. Many of them talked about God's plan. So they said that God had meant that they would be with somebody else going forward. So starting over for the men wasn't living alone. Starting over for most of the men was getting remarried. You know, a smaller set of men said, I'd only get remarried if she had these amazing traits. And then only the smallest set of men said, oh, I'd never get remarried because it was too emotionally difficult. And women were the exact reverse. So they, you know, when they talked about being happier after the great divorce, they meant happier and not getting remarried. They talked about not being wanting to be a companion to someone, not wanting to have that role in their lives, and wanting to live independently with independence and freedom going forward. And only the smallest number of women said, yes, I'll go ahead and think about remarrying again. I think it's an important part of my life going forward.
But then you write, gray divorce, splitting up in midlife, is an increasingly acceptable choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, in society in general, divorce at any age is becoming more acceptable. And as we see more and more baby boomers cross that age threshold of 50, you know, we're going to see more and more of these divorces. And seeing more and more of them, I do believe, is going to make it more acceptable. So the real issue is, how can we as a society take care of the issues that come up around a gray divorce, the economic issues as well as the social issues, while also keeping in mind that even though loneliness is a significant cost that both sexes pay, it, at least in the short run, they also saw many positive aspects of being starting over or emerging from a bad marriage, potentially remarrying in the future. So not all is lost, and I tried to really end the book and the discussion on such a positive note, because that's how they viewed their lives going forward.
And it's been great having you. The title of the book is Gray Divorce: What We Lose and Gain from Midlife Splits. Our guest has been Professor Droshlyn Crowley, and thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
So let's just talk about, let me read from her book, Divorce is a True Gamble. And thinking about whether to initiate or agree to a divorce action, individuals must weigh the pros of living on their own terms against the cons of being separated from their spouses whom they used to love. It is no wonder that those experiencing a gray divorce have conflicting feelings about their marital breakdowns. Many of these marriages have been of a long duration, usually also producing children to create larger and more complex family units overall. With a divorce, these couples are hoping that the good will outweigh the bad as they construct new lives on their own terms. On this point, while these men and women were able to articulate the worst part of being divorced at this point in their lives, they were also able to describe many times with wild enthusiasm their optimism about their futures. In other words, for many, gray divorce was not the end, but rather the beginning of a new life journey. We can say the same about the Feast of Pentecost, as we allow God then to enter our lives more fully, to become a part of us, to guide us, to inspire us, to share many gifts with us that we may not recognize now, but each and every one of you listening to this has in some way been gifted by God this day. And you may not recognize that gift right away, but it will help you to deal with life better, will help you to see your true strengths and to show you when to use them and how to use them so that there is so much more good within each of us that God can reveal to us. And that's part of the message of Pentecost, because the Spirit of God is a spirit of love, and there can be nothing more powerful than that spirit of love in the face of so many of the problems that we face, the separations in family life, the struggles that go on between, as we've been speaking about tonight, husbands and wives and children and the decisions that they must make. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.